Right now, I'm very pleased to welcome the incumbent Democrat Congresswoman who represents the 7th Congressional District that makes up much of our listening audience, Abigail Spanberger. And I saw you at the July 4th event out in Powhatan, and I wanted to have you back on the show, and you said you would come. And so first, let me thank you for keeping your word and being willing to come on WRVA on this program. I appreciate it.
Absolutely, John. Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah. Well, I know you wanted to talk a little bit about the pressing issue before Congress, which is, and I do too, about what we're going to spend to try to get us to the other side of this pandemic and make sure that businesses don't go under and that individuals don't sink either. What's the real issue here? It's the final number of how much we're going to pay for each individual person?
Well, so, John, before I answer that question, I'm noting that you're going to have the VA secretary on to talk about some of the challenges that they're facing. I just want to, you know, raise the issue of broadband internet access, which is something that I've been working on since the day I arrived in Congress, because while this is a major priority for the VA to be able to deliver telehealth services, it cuts down on even everything as simple as parking over at McGuire, particularly in a pandemic, the ability to deliver services. If our veterans, particularly in our rural communities, don't have access to internet, they can't utilize those VA services. So this has been a major issue of mine. I led an effort with an original co-sponsor of a large-scale bill that ultimately we passed just last month as part of a larger infrastructure package that would really coast-to-coast invest in large-scale broadband internet packages and programs to ensure that our nation's veterans, our students, and our small businesses have access to this vital infrastructure. But to get to your question related to the real issue, you know, I think one of the real issues is there's the reality of functioning in a pandemic, right? It's just as it's impacted people's ability in whatever their job is, it is very difficult for a large group of us to get in a room and hammer things out. And in this case of a pandemic, it has kind of spun towards the place where there's really six people at this point that are leading all of the negotiations. And I do not think that that's particularly advantageous for the American people. You know, I was disappointed back in May when my own party brought forth a bill, which I ultimately voted against, that was meant to be the COVID-4 relief package. I voted against that bill at the time because I said it was a distraction. It had far more than just COVID-related relief to it. It was utilizing the valuable time that we had back in May, knowing that our July 31st day was coming. We spent time bringing everybody back to Washington, voting on that package when we should have been getting whatever number of people is safe to get in a room to hammer out how we actually move forward. Then the Senate sort of pulled the same type of stunt. They pushed out their bill, and notably there was strong divisions even within the Republican conference in the Senate. And so now here we are, the July 31st day has lapsed, and we don't have an agreement. And at this point, it sounds like we're a little bit further from one than, of course, I would want to be. I would want us to have had and planned for. We knew July 31st was coming. We should have been planning for it. We should have had a package knocked out. But the things that I'm really advocating for and continue to advocate for, first and foremost, it's a national testing strategy. Everything from our schools to our businesses to our communities, the only way we're going to be able to open them safely is by having tests that take a lot less than a week, which is what we're seeing in a lot of places in Central Virginia, to get those test results back. We need fast return testing. We need contact tracing so that as we open up, we can do so tactically, react when there's a potential outbreak, and then move from there. State and local funding. The 10 counties that I represent are all well-run, very responsible counties in how they spend and utilize their funds. And they have all planned for a rainy day, but a global pandemic that shuts down the economy in a place where we're seeing, you know, our GDPs plunged is the worst level ever than it ever has. It's the Great Depression, the Great Recession. There's never been a slump like this in the past two centuries with the GDP fall of 32%. And so support to our local governments is incredibly important. That supports our first responders, our police, our schools, the basic function of our community. And then ensuring that people can meet their basic needs, putting food on the table and a roof over their head. I've spoken with a number of economists, and one thing I'm very worried about, and in fact, I was happy to hear the president talk about this just yesterday, is a potential looming housing crisis if we do see mass levels of eviction or housing foreclosures. That's another thing that we absolutely must prioritize avoiding. And then ensuring that our small businesses and employers, frankly, of any size, can continue employing people through the challenge of the pandemic, but certainly that when it's safe to open doors, and of course, in the area that I represent, we're mostly in phase three, that in fact those businesses still have doors to open. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I was a supporter of the PPP program, both the first time around and the second time we came back to change some of the rulemaking around it to make it a little bit more flexible for small businesses and to push more funds into that program. So those are the priorities that I have. And at this point, we need a deal immediately because people are hurting and businesses are hurting and doors are closing that will never open again.
Well, that is certainly true. So there are two issues there that I want to touch on. One, I mean, is the price tag here is so enormous. I mean, it's not even a moderate price, even when we're talking about the Republican plan, and the Democrat plan is, what, two times that. So isn't that a real dilemma for you as somebody who has to vote on that plan, that we're going to mortgage the future?
The future to pay for the now? Yeah, no, thank you for asking this question, because I care deeply about deficit and debt issues. I was among a bipartisan group of members of Congress saying that we need to set out a plan, a long-term plan for how we're going to contend with the debt, recognizing that right now we are in an economic crisis, and we have to respond to the immediacy of that crisis. Investments in things like rental assistance, if those investments help us avoid a housing crisis, then those investments are worth it. But we have to be looking at what are the responses that are investments to help put us back on a steadier path into the future. And so that's one of the reasons why I voted against the Democratic bill, the HEROES Act, back in May, is there was much more to it than response to the crisis. Mm-hmm. And not saying that some of those things weren't worthy of potential debates later on, but it needs to be outside of the scope of a must pass. We are all, you know, going to have to come to the table and try and deliver immediacy of investment and relief to people and businesses and our communities. And so that's how I'm looking at it.
But don't you think one of the things we could do to solve the problem would be to get the governor to kind of kick open the door and let's get back to work, understanding now that we've got good data and we know who's at risk or at the most risk and who's at least risk, that some of this is self-inflicted. Some of this economic damage at this stage is self-inflicted because we're still under these, I think, kind of artificial restraints that Governor Northam's put in place.
Well, so, and as we saw, Dr. Birx even just over the weekend was talking about the fact that the virus, you know, is not where it was in March and April, which is where, in more isolated. Now it is everywhere. It is across our rural communities. We're seeing this outbreak like we saw at the Georgia summer camp, you know, where they took every precaution in the world from everything I've read. The adults all wore masks. They tested everyone. They temperature checks and all the rest. And still they had more than 100 children come down with it. So I think it's about striking a balance. But this is where the testing really becomes the biggest priority because, you know, there's an individual I know, and I'll be protecting for her privacy, an individual I know and work with closely, thought that she might have symptoms, went and took a test. In the end, it took more than 7 days to get the results. Mm-hmm. Now, she's lucky that she's able to work from home and be able to isolate even within her own home. Mm-hmm. But had she had young children, I mean, all of these things, because her test took more than 7 days to come back. And this is the place where we're seeing real challenges, because if we have the immediacy of testing, which does exist, you know, in depending upon where you get your test, there are faster tests out there, but it becomes a supply chain issue of reagents and the nasal pharyngeal swabs, which is why I've joined with colleagues, Republicans and Democrats, to push for more resiliency in our supply chain, because frankly, what we were seeing back in March and April, where we were worried about overwhelming our hospital systems, and we did see some hospital systems overwhelmed, where we were worried about the potential shortages of ventilators. You know, those are the large scale items, but it's the swabs, it's the PPE. Frankly, when we get a vaccine and you know, ideally we're on a strong path towards that. It's going to be the delivery mechanism of that vaccine. We might have the dosages, but if you don't have the syringes to deliver them, then you don't actually have the ability to deliver that vaccine.
I don't want to belabor the point, but are you hearing from restaurant owners and people who run businesses in the district who are saying, hey, we're dying here, and we know who's at risk, and the our clientele aren't the people who are going to go to the hospital or die based on the data. Can you do something to help get us, you know, back to 80%, 90%, 100% operation?
So the conversations that I've had with restaurant owners and my engagement with the Restaurant Owners Association, and I'm working on a bill that at this point we're waiting for the final go-ahead from one of my Republican colleagues to help just with this, to make sure that, you know, restaurant owners or other small business owners who know what it is that they have to do to make their businesses safe, who are following all the guidance, one, they need support in doing that, right? That's what I'm hearing from restaurant owners and other small business owners, but I'll speak specifically to the restaurant industry right now. But the other challenge that they're having, which is a greater one, because it's a much harder challenge to address, is consumer confidence and consumer fear, right? So they know that they have their staff is wearing masks. They know how well they're sanitizing things. They know the processes that they're undergoing. But an element of that is then how do they convey that to their customers? How do they ensure that people who are afraid will start going back out to restaurants? There's been kind of strong pushes for doing takeout, which people seem a lot more comfortable with. Yeah. But, you know, what I've heard from restaurant owners is even if we could open up 100% right now, we're not comfortable that the people are there 100%.
Well, that may be true, you know, there's not much you can do to legislate that. The liability issue is one. And I am watching the clock. I feel like I got to get to this because so many people wrote me directly and asked me to ask you. And I'm going to put you on the spot here. I went through on your website trying to find some statements from you about the violence in Richmond and the Black Lives Matter movement in general. And unless I missed it, I couldn't find a lot. And I took note that you marched in Louisa in a march that some people are calling a defund the police movement, which seems in contrast with what you told
very
voters.
Very much. Tell me
how you feel about the violence in Richmond, because I didn't see anything. And if I missed it, correct me. Tell me what I missed.
Well, sure. And I'll start with just the basics. I do not, categorically, do not support defunding the police. We are asking so much of our police officers, and that's among the conversations I've had with sheriffs and police officers and police chiefs across our 10 counties on some group calls and on some individual calls, particularly with the rise of overdoses, responses related to addiction, mental health crises, particularly during this pandemic and economic crisis. We are asking so much of our police forces, and I absolutely do not support defunding the police. That's one of the reasons why I'm pushing for state and local funding, because that funding goes towards our localities, funding first responders, police, schools. I also, in the Justice and Policing Act that we passed in the House, it actually increases funding for police departments for training and additional resources. The event in Louisa was a Unity Louisa. I did not see a single sign that had any kind of questionable signage. I did read something that where one person gave an interview, but the entire tone and tenor, and notably there were trackers there who were filming things. There were reports from Charlottesville News, was unity, bringing people together, the value of a vote. Mm-hmm. In terms of the violence and the looting that we've seen in Richmond, I absolutely do not support, and I absolutely condemn anyone who's breaking the law. VCU alone reported that they had $100,000 worth of damage. That's taxpayer dollars damage. That's parents who are paying tuition, paying for that damage. That's money that doesn't get put into, you know, upgrades to dorms. That's money that doesn't buy PPE at their hospital system. I absolutely do not support that.
But can I ask you, though, did you speak out about it when it was happening? I mean, that's one of the frustrations I've got with many of our elected officials, is they just kind of let this happen without loudly condemning it. And correct me if I'm wrong, were you out there saying that this was not the way to behave? A lot of them were your people, liberal voters.
So I, in the district that I represent, which does not include the city of Richmond, when I have been out at events, there have been And I think it's important to differentiate. There have been rallies. There have been, First Amendment right style people talking about the importance of vote, people talking about the importance of racial equity and justice. The events that I have attended, there have been police officers marching right alongside. There's been, community-driven events. And those are the events when people are using their voice, advocating for what they believe in, and doing it in a way of nonviolent protests, particularly in the wake of Congressman John Lewis's death. I think that he spoke out in the world in favor of nonviolent social change. And violence is never an effective avenue for change. I'm a former law enforcement officer myself. The idea that social change would have come through breaking the law and hurting people and things is never the path forward, never the right path. I'll say that. I'll say that anytime anyone asks. So
all right.
I
well, let's pick up the conversation. Listen, sincerely, I do appreciate the fact that you're willing to come on WRVA, and hopefully we'll have a number of conversations with you and your Republican opponent, Nick Freitas, going forward. The incumbent Democrat Congresswoman from the 7th Congressional District, Abigail Spanberger, thank you.